Good morning, Dave.
Good morning, Steele.
How's life?
Oh, Steele, it's fantastic. I've had some insomnia the last couple weeks, and so I look terrible and I feel pretty terrible as well, but I'm working on it. Last night I slept at least 5 hours and it was great.
Dave, I'm super excited today for our episode because we have a very special guest.
Steele, this is my best friend ever. That's how I'll introduce him. We haven't had him on before because I thought he would mock us too much. But I think that we've done this long enough and his heart has softened enough to where we can have Matt Howard on the podcast. How you doing, Matt?
Yeah, I'm doing well, Dave. Thanks. And you are right to guard your heart from me. Because I think this is like kind of stupid. If we just get started, I'd appreciate it.
Matt, it's great to have you on. We have a
Thanks,
lot
Matt.
To cover today. We are going to be talking about one of the great pleasures of summer, which is water in its myriad forms. We're going to be talking about some great moments in advertising. I don't know whose idea that one was. We got a special segment of Small Talk. We've got a very new segment called Off the Chain Money, where we're going to give you some advice for dealing with automobiles. We've got a section called Would You Rather? And then, of course, we've got Unchained Melodies and Book Wisdom. So a lot to run through. Let's get started.
All right.
I wanted to start, talking about summer, one of the great pleasures of summer. Yesterday, my wife took Cedar to Milwaukee, and when they're in Milwaukee, they went to a splash park. Just got to see photographs of the kid playing in water and just enjoying himself. And it made me realize I love water parks and I love springboard diving boards. There's nothing that I would rather do than go stand in a brief line and jump off a diving board.
Wait, why springboards? Like water parks I'm on board with, but springboards, what's the deal?
Well, you get to run to the end of a plank and you can jump as high as you can and then it sends you jumping even higher. Then you're just flying through the air and landing in water. It's amazing. You can do flip. You can just act spastically and it doesn't hurt when you land. It's amazing. I still love it. I will always love it.
Actually, I was talking to you the other day, Steele. We just went to Manti, Utah. Tiny town. They have a sweet swimming pool with this awesome, probably, I don't know, 50-foot long spiraling slide.
Just open to the public?
Yeah, but we rented it out. It was a family reunion, so it was just my family, like nieces and nephews and stuff. And it was awesome because anytime I've tried to take one of my kids on a slide anywhere in Phoenix, everyone's like, you can't take a toddler on this water slide. This is too tough. So we kept taking
off. That's just because they don't know your kids, Dave.
There's such thing as danger if you're a good parent.
And in Manti, Utah, there's no such thing as danger. So we just kept going down the water slide with my girls. Every time you get to the bottom, you'd hold them up and it'd splash them. And they were just so excited. And they would say, again, again.
Yes. Those are my kind of girls. My wife is terrified of water slides. We went to a water park for my birthday a couple years ago. And she was telling me that she was scared, but I didn't realize how scared she was until we got on one of those big rides where you're on a big tube, a circle, and I was facing her. And I got to see her face as we were going down the slide. And I realized, okay, that's it. I'll just go on all the rides by myself. You don't have to come with me anymore. Just sit it out.
Well, guys, we have a water park here in Cedar City.
Great name, by the way.
It's a great name, great town. My kids recently finished swimming lessons there, and they still can't swim. But we took them back after swimming lessons. And we were swimming there one time, and the lifeguards start blowing on the whistle, this long, sustained. They won't stop blowing on the whistles. I don't know what that means, but apparently it means you're supposed to get out of the pool.
Yeah.
And they wanted us to get out because there was poop in the water.
Nice.
I just kind of assumed that there was always poop in the water, but apparently when they spot it, they make a big deal about it. And so they made us stay out for like 45 minutes or an hour to clean all that stuff out. And it just kind of got me thinking about all the number of times that I've pooped in the water. And I guess people take it a lot more seriously than I do. They took it pretty seriously there.
I'm definitely a pool peer, but I'm not so much of a pool pooper.
You know, it's the conditions have to be right. It's not something you're going to do every time. Like, you're going to pee in the pool every time, for
yeah,
sure.
Every
but pooping,
time.
Not every time. It has to be, the mood has to be right.
Yeah. Have you heard about this thing where they add something to the pool so that it turns like bright blue when you pee in it?
Yeah, it's like a shaming principle.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah, you can't pee in the pool anymore. But I found that once I passed 30, I stopped peeing in the pool. It's just like, hey, I'm past 30. It's time to stop urinating in pools. And I haven't done it since then.
That's a shame, Dave. That's just a sign that you've gone soft, really, to me.
There's many signs that I've gone soft. But Howard, were any of your children involved in this poop, do you think?
No, my kids know better than that, man.
You guys can't do it. That's Dad's job. Is that what you told him?
Yeah, it's because I've trained him to poop on command, so I would have known.
Drop and squat.
We have a bunch of neighbor kids that came running up to us yesterday. We were playing on the playground, and they were so excited to tell me that one of the kids, Mehmet, pooped on a tree. And I was like, wow, that's amazing. Mehmet, did you poop on a tree? And he was grinning. He was like, yeah. They were all so excited. They were singing songs about how Mehmet pooped on a tree. And then one little kid came up to me quietly and he said, I just don't think Mehmet has enough respect for trees. He was like, he was the one dissenter. He wasn't showing enough respect for trees.
Now, trees love poop, still. That's tons of respect.
The opposite. I mean, there's nothing that makes tree happier than some poop. It's great nitrogen.
Yeah, is it fertilizer? That tree's going to sprout a bunch of new leaves thanks to Emmett.
I guess I should have.
I got a sweet phone call at work this last week from Mabel, and I didn't get a word in at all whatsoever, but Mabel just picked up the phone and let me know she pooped on the potty. So it was pretty cool.
Nice. Is this a first?
No, that was a first. We're going to wait till they're about 10 to potty train them. So this was a first.
Sweet.
What?
It's a desert ecosystem, Matt. You got to wait. You don't want them fouling up the water table.
But no, in honesty, they probably are ready to be potty trained. But there's three of them. It just seems like we'd have to be really on top of it and crazy for a couple months. And we just haven't done it yet. It's something I just haven't been able to bite off.
Great choice of words for that too, Dave. I was thinking you could just probably draw straws and just train them one at a time. Like each one has a year that they get potty trained. And so the last one's 5 or 6, you know, she's waiting to be potty trained because she drew lots and she was last.
I'm in. Yeah. Potty training terrifies me. Howard, was potty training terrifying for you or you feel good about it?
You mean him personally or his children?
Yeah, both. I know Matt's had a lot of issues.
I don't know if I would completely consider myself fully potty trained yet.
That's what Dan Jenajan told me.
It's not as easy to aim as you think, but you know, I believe if we had known, I don't think God told us about potty training, you know, up before this life, you know, and presenting the idea of coming down here to earth and all this stuff that's going on here. I don't think he told us about it, because I think if he had, a lot of us wouldn't have come.
So you think it's God's fault? You're blaming God for this?
Yes.
And is there a lot of floor urination that happens in your house at this point?
This is the best podcast we've ever done.
It's a sensitive topic. You know, I'm not as aware of that kind of stuff as my wife is, but she asks me to clean the bathroom every day. So, yeah.
I don't want to create any further marital discord, but just...
Sometimes I do it.
Just aim your best, Howard, and tell your boys to do so as well.
Okay, so here is something that's serious, though. My wife's a little mad at me because I taught my boys to urinate standing up, and she seems to think that's why there's so much pee on the floor.
Well, clearly is, but that's probably the way they should learn how to pee. It's just something you got to live with that for a while, just urine on the floor, right?
My thoughts exactly. You know, Dan Jenajan managed.
Just quickly, me and Matt and still all of us were college roommates at some point, and there were multiple shouting matches regarding urine on the floor at some point during our college years. I think a lot of us just felt like we could roll with it. Urine on the floor is going to happen, but some of us felt like it was inappropriate.
Tell you what, there were never shouting matches in our apartment. It was always your guys' apartment. So you had an uptight Nancy living with you.
Yeah, there was urine all over the floor in your bathroom. No one cared.
No.
I wonder if that guy Dan Jenajan even knows that, like, people pee in swimming pools.
He'd be furious. Wouldn't he be furious about that?
He'd be like, this whole time, nobody told me.
I've been swimming in that stuff.
This is a public place. You can't do that.
All right. Well, that's the, I mean, I guess the greatest parts of summer. Spending time in water, making water. We covered it all.
Steele, I'm excited about this next segment. When I mentioned it to you before, you didn't seem to understand exactly where I'm coming from. So I'm going to explain it just a little bit.
Please.
We've all had commercials that have touched our lives in some way, that have changed our behavior, and have changed the behavior of the entire nation. I just want to talk about a few and talk about how awesome they were, why we think they may have worked, and our just our hopes for the future for them.
Yeah, I think it was probably my fault. I was just surprised by your choice of words. I think you said something about great moments in advertising, and I choked a little bit. I thought you accidentally said great. That was so funny.
Steele, there have been many great moments in advertising, and one of the greatest that I remember from my childhood is Where's the Beef? Hey, you remember that, Howard?
You know, Dave, I didn't have a television growing up.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no.
So I don't know how helpful I'm going to be on this one. You know, I missed a lot of these, but I do seem to remember that question a lot.
Nice. Way to be a sidekick. That was great.
Well, it was an important question. It was first introduced by Wendy's. There was a group of old ladies staring at a large hamburger bun, and they flipped it up. It was just all bun. There was no beef. And she said, "Where's the beef?"
Oh,
and
man.
It became a cultural phenomenon. There's like "Where's the Beef" t-shirts. Someone recorded a "Where's the Beef" hit single, and it was just all over the place. This phrase caught on. It was being used in political campaigns. The same year it came out, I think Walter Mondale used it as a way to criticize the other Democratic people in the field. Like, "Where's the beef in your proposals?"
Nice. You know, fantastic. Dave, what I would have done, I think the better t-shirt would have been "All Bun, No Beef."
That's,
wear that in the back of your sweatpants.
Pretty thought-provoking. Why so much bun? Why?
But like, I genuinely find it interesting that there's these different phrases, these different commercials that somehow become a cultural phenomenon. Like, yeah. Where's the beef? It blew up. It was everywhere. I don't know. Why do you think this would happen? Why would people latch on to something like this?
I think it's probably, we talk about it now in internet culture as like these viral memes or whatever, but it's usually like a short snippet that people think is either funny or comic, or it triggers some kind of instant emotional response. And I don't know why they catch on or what the theory is, but if it's just a shared cultural thing, people feel like, hey, I can say this real fast. It makes other people laugh. They have some kind of funny association, then they'll use it and all. I don't know.
Dave, I don't know how to break this to you, but I think you might not have considered this before, but there's probably a slight sexual undertone to that question that might have a part to play in its popularity.
Yeah.
Just saying, maybe.
No way, Howard. This is Wendy's. It's family friendly.
And it was a bunch of old ladies asking it, which makes it way better.
You guys well know that you get to throw a dirty joke into polite company without getting, you know, in trouble for it is going to be taken advantage of.
Yeah. Veiled dirty jokes. There's nothing better than those.
I think that's most of what you've said and done on this podcast, Steele, in the past 6 months. So
I think that's fair. Yeah.
Mostly. Yeah. I thought about this. You know, I don't know if you guys knew this, but I worked with Alan Stouffer for probably a summer. We would deliver food to the Museum of Art Cafe and the Business School Cafe. And I think it was sometime between him, right after he dropped all the apples across the MOA parking lot and right before he dropped all the pan of cookies at the business school. But we got to start talking about ads. And we talked about this one ad in particular, which is, it was filmed in 1993, and it's a Listerine can swinging through the jungle like Tarzan.
Oh, man. And was there a song associated?
Yeah, Tarzan. I mean, that's the whole thing. That's why it's funny that we both started talking about this. We had a deep connection, and I personally think that that's why that commercial was made, so that Alan and I could have something to connect over.
That's a really sweet thought, Matt. I kind of imagine Alan in that job as being like, imagining it was like a cartoon where there's a dog that dresses up as a human one day, and he's walking around on his hind legs all day, but he only has paws, and so it's real hard for him to do stuff with his hands. That's sort of how I imagine Alan working in that job.
Whoa, drop the cheesecake. Guess we have to eat it.
Exactly.
But I remember that commercial, which of course I do, because I had a terrible addiction to television throughout the 90s. And it's fantastic. It's refreshing. the song comes in, the Listerine bottle swinging. I watched it yesterday. There were comments saying that I started using Listerine after I saw that commercial, and I agree. I'd never used it before I saw that commercial, and now I have a bottle of Listerine in my bathroom right now.
Is it the one that's like, oh?
Of course it is.
Okay, I recognize that sound from anywhere, but I had no idea where it came from.
That's how good it is, man.
Well, yeah, somehow when you're putting together your ad, if you can get a song like that and an iconic bottle of Listerine swinging through the jungle, I still know it. No one ever forgets it. And it's the basis for Howard's and Stouffer's friendship.
Yeah,
I mean, I think he was like singing it in the delivery truck as he was dropping produce or something. And like, oh, Listerine man. And it was like,
love at first sight.
Slowed down for a minute. Our eyes connected. It was beautiful.
That's amazing. I love that. That sounds like something Alan would sing at work.
So I got one more I want to talk about. You guys remember anything about the 90s and television commercials? You remember the Mountain Dew was extreme. Ooh. Everything they did was extreme. And every commercial they had, a guy tilting his head back and holding the dew can about a foot away from him. And the stream of dew is just pouring into his mouth because he just jumped out of a helicopter or something.
Man, you have this thing for really sexual commercials, Dave. Everything you're mentioning here.
Is that what they call it? The dew stream?
A lot of repressed stuff from your childhood's coming out here, Dave.
The dew stream. Available in cities,
so extreme.
Yeah? This summer only. The dew stream.
Guys, I didn't have a lot of friends in the 90s. Wasn't the best time for me. But the commercial I picked in particular is they have a giant slingshot and they're shooting dudes. Now everything I say sounds extremely sexual.
Yeah, Dave. Keep it up though, man. It sounds like a great commercial.
I don't know if I can finish this. They're shooting guys off a jump. And it's snow involved, snow skiing. Extreme sports, everybody's holding a dew can, throwing it back, doing the dew. They're doing the dew.
Wow. I seem to remember one, Dave, where there was skydiving involved. Is this the same? This is a different commercial, though.
No, every single Mountain Dew commercial that's ever occurred has skydiving involved. That's all of them.
You know, I watched that commercial, Dave, and they were slingshotting these guys down a snowy mountain.
Yes.
I don't know if they quite understood that.
Principle of gravity.
Yeah, but, you know, these guys were on skis already. It was really, I was kind of, but it was awesome.
No, in a normal commercial, Howard, you might just ski down a mountain. But when you're taking it to the next level, you're being extreme. You have to be slingshotted down a mountain holding a Mountain Dew. That's where the connection is. And that's why I drank so much Mountain Dew in the 90s.
Do you think these guys are trying to compensate for something by adding all this extremeness into their commercials?
Clearly. Did you hear the story Dave just told about why Mountain Dew appealed to him? Obviously, it's compensatory.
Wow.
I've never had Mountain Dew, actually. There's my contribution to this segment.
You've never had Mountain Dew?
No, never tasted it.
Well, the one interesting thing I know about it was originally like a mountain person hillbilly drink. And that's how everybody saw it. And so the makers of Mountain Dew wanted to change stuff, and they did it by all this extreme sports stuff. So now it's like, I'm 15, I'm awesome, I'm drinking Mountain Dew.
I associate it with video gamers, pretty much. People who do extreme things to their avatar.
You might find yourself in a really select, small group of people that could be a part of control studies, of people that haven't ever drank before. I mean, that's a pretty...
It's me and a bunch of, like, Bolivian pygmies.
Yeah. You know, I can't think about Mountain Dew without I had a friend, Dave's met this guy, Brendan, who would always, anytime people drank Mountain Dew, he would say, let's go Yellow 5 in it, it'll shrink your penis. He would say that every time.
Speaking of compensation, man, some people are really worried about that stuff.
The more you say it, the truer it gets.
Those were some great moments in advertising, Dave. I take it all back.
I knew you'd appreciate it still. I knew that each product would be one that would be close to your heart. And I'd say Mountain Dew's delicious, man. Next time you're skydiving or skiing with a slingshot, bring one along, man.
I'll do the dew.
and make sure when you drink it, you have your head tilted back
as far as
and the can's
go.
About a foot away from you. Yeah, so yeah,
majestic pose. Well, we've got a segment of small talk. This is always a great treasure. We just bring up a couple of things that you can use in your next conversation.
Like I said, we were just in Manti, Utah, and my brother-in-law there is an interesting man. He's a trampoline guru. He sells and makes cellar sizers. They're fantastic. So he's way into health and fitness. And on the side of his house, he's got a sauna. Proper pronunciation would be sauna,
sauna,
I believe.
If you're from Suomi.
Oh.
Finland.
Yeah, the Finns love saunas, and I love it. I went in the sauna with some family, and it was just a fantastic experience. He had some frankincense in there, and so we poured a little frankincense on the rocks, and it filled up your lungs, went through your nose. It is just a delightful experience. And I found an article about the 8 benefits of saunas. Did you know there were that many?
No.
I had no idea. I didn't even know there was one benefit.
And that's why I'm here. And this is the perfect thing to talk about with people that are ignorant, like you guys. You get them in the corner in a party room and you're telling them about saunas, and you're really enlightening these people.
And it just sounds so casual, Dave. You're like, hey, did you know about the 8 benefits of saunas? I mean, everybody's like, oh, wow, that seems so natural that it would come up in this conversation.
Everyone
has a sauna. We could go visit him if you want. Just me and you. Nobody else would have to be there.
Let's do the do.
We could bring some Mountain Dew. Just quick, guys. I want to just tell you about these. Saunas flush toxins. They help in weight loss.
Nice.
They make your immune system stronger. Perhaps most importantly, saunas promote.
Stop questioning, Steele. Just believe.
Steele, this is a list, and obviously it's on the internet, so it's all true.
Sorry. Continue.
Saunas promote social interaction.
Among naked
maybe
men.
And women. It's by gender. It's fine. Saunas improve performance during endurance sports. Saunas make hair look great. Saunas help to recover from workouts. And finally, saunas help you look younger. Did you know that?
Wow, I didn't. It sounds like I'm going to find myself a sauna soon and go check one out for myself.
Yeah, get some people together and just talk about all the benefits you're experiencing because you're in the sauna.
So, Dave, is the reason why I look like a bald man in his mid-40s because I don't spend enough time in the sauna?
Yeah, exactly. And you've looked like that for the entire 20 years that I've known you.
I know.
And you should have started in saunas a long time ago.
It is true, Howard. You're kind of an ageless wonder, really.
You'll always be 45, no matter what.
Oh, guys, I have something to contribute to small talk. I read a great article in the Washington Post. So politics is basically the worst, and it doesn't take a lot to really know that. But I read about this book. This guy is named Barton Swaim, which is one of the all-time great names. He could probably never run for office himself, but he became a speechwriter for the South Carolina governor, Mark Sanford. Do you guys remember this guy? He had the big scandal. He had like a girlfriend in Argentina, and then he disappeared on the Appalachian Trail for a couple days and then had a mistress. And anyway.
Yeah, he was a winner. I sort of, you'd have to really do some interesting stuff for me to remember who you are as the South Carolina governor.
So he definitely did it. But this guy was his speechwriter, and he wrote a book about what it's like to be a speechwriter for a politician who's essentially like an egotistical idiot. And it sounded amazing. So one of the things that Mark Sanford loved is that he would never give speeches unless he had at least 3 points in a speech. He said, I'm not getting out there to talk about 2 stupid points. I need 3 points. First, second, third. Got that? So put that in your pocket. You got to have 3 points. The 3 benefits of saunas, not the 2. The 3 benefits. And then whenever they draft a press statement or if they weren't sure if he's going to approve it, they would always put the phrase, a larger notion, in there. And as long as it made reference to the larger notion, he was fine with it. He would sign off on everything. He loved it.
Sounds like a winning formula for writing just in general.
Yeah.
You thought about incorporating that into your thesis, Steele?
I'm thinking about a couple larger notions here and there. But it just sounds like this guy was awful. Just terribly awful. She has these conversations with the staff after his infidelity revelations come out. And he says, I just wanted to say the obvious, which is the obvious. I mean, the obvious, which is that I caused the storm that we're in now. So he mentions Man's Search for Meaning, which is an Auschwitz memoir by Viktor Frankl. And then he says, you can find beauty, you can find reasons to keep going in the most appalling circumstances. We're not in a concentration camp, so let's not stay in the dumps.
Oh, man, that's an excellent point. But that's only two. He stayed in the obvious in Auschwitz. Where's his third point?
And then he says, okay, listen, Swaim, I need you to write a story. I need you to take all of the words like integrity and honesty out of my form letters because it will remind people of the scandal. And then come up with a few examples from the Bible or from history or from whatever that kind of show, you know, how that when you've made a mess, you can do the best you can to clean it up. You make it right the best you can, and you just keep going. That was his big message to the guy. So
great third point.
It was amazing. Apparently, I didn't realize this because I thought he would have resigned in disgrace and left politics. But no, he's back in Congress now. He won a special election in 2013, and he is representing South Carolina in Congress currently.
Really?
Yes.
He's in Congress?
He's in Congress in South Carolina.
Well, he turned it around. He just kept making those 3 points.
We're not in a concentration camp. Let's not stay in the dumps.
No. There's something from the Bible that's surely going to get me out of this.
So anyway, I want to read the book now. This Barton Swaim guy sounds amazing. And Mark Sanford sounds like a total piece of trash.
All I've got for small talk, guys, this is actually surprisingly difficult for me.
That's why we have this segment, Matt.
Thank you, because it's made me painfully aware of how pathetic I am at small talk. But reading Rainbow, remember Geordi from Star Trek? He had his own reading show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
It's going to be on Netflix in August. This is a big deal. And although I don't think I've ever actually seen it, I know that it's a big thing. And you can get people start talking about that, and they'll probably talk for a long time and think that you're like an amazing conversationalist.
So, Matt, are they remaking it, making new episodes, or are they bringing all the old episodes onto Netflix?
It's the old episodes, Steve.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm assuming neither of you have ever seen it. So do you guys not know the Reading Rainbow theme song? That's just anyone.
I can do anything.
Oh, thank you.
Take a look. It's in a book. A Reading Rainbow.
I should have known, Steele. It was on PBS, so you've seen it. You've experienced it.
Yeah.
Public broadcasting.
Yep. That's what I was into as a 4-year-old. I was like, bring me more Charlie Rose.
Let's talk about books more.
There's too much video.
Well,
I
was
the worst kid. Such a nerd.
You're still there. You're still there.
I know. Well, thanks, Howard. Thanks, Dave. Small talk. The 8 benefits of saunas. Don't become a political speechwriter. And Reading Rainbow is coming to Netflix. All exciting news. Okay, this next segment's really important. We're intending this to be kind of a public service for our listeners. We wanted to start a regular segment. It's called Off the Chain Money, where Dave and I and our various guests just basically give financial advice to help you manage something that's a big stressor for a lot of people. And that's their finances. That's money. The topic we wanted to address today is one that comes up for most Americans, and it's buying an automobile. And I think, Dave, this is something that was on your mind, especially lately.
Steele, I've never purchased an automobile without feeling like I was just terribly ripped off somehow. It's never gone well. Every time, like, I show up, I remember the first time we bought a car when we were married, we went to a dealership, not a good idea.
No.
And before we knew it, we were buying like I don't remember how much it was, but it was $12,000 to $15,000 for a car. I'm like, this is a good idea, right? And of course, the salesman's like, this is a great idea, guys. We need to get this done right now. So they're rushing you. They're trying to push you. And before we know it, we've got a Subaru Forester, and it was a great car. But I didn't need to spend that much money on a vehicle.
So, Dave, I've never bought a car from a dealership. But I would say
Tip number one.
The very first car that I ever remember being involved with, my mom bought for me when I was going to college. She thought I needed a car. And I was like, Mom, I really don't need a car. I don't like driving. I don't want to drive. I don't need a car. But she found an ad in the newspaper from this it was an Avon saleswoman. So you know how Mary Kay always have their salespeople in pink cars? Does that sound right?
Yeah.
This lady sold for Avon, and so it wasn't pink, it was Band-Aid colored. I think Avon has their own, like, knockoff version of this. I think it was like a Ford Taurus. It was a Band-Aid colored Ford Taurus, and it was an 85-year-old grandmother that had been a smoker. So my mom bought this car from her, and I took it down to college freshman year. It was called the Band-Aid, and I basically had two keys for it. And I would just let one set of keys circulate around the dorm so that anyone who wanted to drive it could take it on dates and stuff. That and then I had the other set of keys. We'd always see, go out in the parking lot, try to find it because we didn't know where it would be parked because we didn't know who had used it last. And there'd be somebody sitting in it making out. It was an awesome car.
Are you the first 18-year-old in the history that said, "Hey, Mom, you know what? I don't need a car."
Probably. Every time I tell stories like this, I probably just reveal how unusual I really think.
Yeah. You know, Mom, no, I don't need a car for college. But if we get one, let's get one that's skin-colored and smells like smoke. I think that would work out well.
And I would like a second set of keys so I could just let anyone who wants to borrow it. Yeah.
Well, I'm actually looking to buy a car right now.
Nice. Oh, perfect.
Yeah. Perfect timing. The car I've been driving for 10 years died, just totally died. And it's amazing that at first I was thinking maybe I'd car loan, and I was comfortable with spending like $10,000 or $15,000. And then I decided, no, I'm going to pay cash. And all of a sudden I wasn't comfortable with spending $10,000 or $15,000 anymore once I was going to pay cash.
Yeah.
It was amazing how quickly my mind changed when I was going to actually use my own money. At first, my idea was I'm going to spend $3,000, and I went shopping for some cars, and I went and shopped for one car, and it was the exact same car that Dave had when we were in college together, green Honda.
Nice.
I'll just say that after that experience, I decided I would up my budget to $5,000.
I bought two cars with cash. The first one was a Dodge Neon. And I didn't know anything, so I didn't know to do like a title check on any of this stuff or like a VIN number check. And the car had been totaled, which is always a good sign. And when I went to go get the title changed over to my name like 2 months later, I realized there was like a $1,500 lien on the car, with unpaid debt on this car in like Texas. Fortunately, we got it all worked out, but I didn't receive the title in hand for probably 3 or 4 months of driving this car. I had this car without a title. So that's another pro tip. Check to see the owner history. Make sure that it's got a clean title and that you know whether it's been totaled in the past or not, because that affects its value and its resale value and potentially how it functions on the road. The second car I bought, though, was a Geo Metro.
Oh, classy.
Yeah, these are some nice cars, man.
Yeah.
And I got this car for $100 right after my divorce. I was in a bad way, obviously, and I had a friend who was leaving town, and they're like, "Hey, I'm selling this car for $100," and I was like, "I am in." I bought it. It was a great car. It ran beautifully. Everything about it was wonderful, except that there was no handle on the driver's side. So I took a hanger, and I built a little handle out of a hanger, and that was the only problem I had with the car. Drove it for several years, and then the transmission went out, and so I sold it for $1 to Landon Donovan's brother.
So from the sound of things, Steele's never been ripped off buying a car, and Dave has been only ripped off buying a car.
Yeah, I've just had great deals, so I'm a pro on buying a car thing.
I would recommend watching a lot of car commercials before you make your car, because you never know how miserable your life is without a certain model of a car until you watch these commercials. There's this commercial that I just became aware of, and it's called The Cog. It was aired in 2003 in Great Britain. It's by Honda. It's about the Accord.
Mm.
And it is, It blew my mind. It's like this enormous Rube Goldberg contraption out of car parts. It blew my mind. And they've watched it like 15 times, and it's just amazing. And I'm going to buy a 2003 Honda Accord. I was thinking about buying a Civic, but I'm afraid that it won't work as well as the Accord because that ad, it wasn't about the Civic, it was about the Accord.
We had a 2003 Honda Accord. Actually, no, it was a Honda Civic. It worked great, but the Accord would have been a bit finer of a car. I mean, it would have been a better car.
Well, it's a nicer model.
The tagline is, isn't it nice when things just work?
Yeah, it is.
I think, man, if I would have seen that ad in 2003, my life would be a lot different right now.
How would it be different, do you think?
Things would have just worked. I think in 2003 was right when I got kicked out of BYU and was working at a gas station and as a janitor. You know, and shortly after 2003, I bought a 1978 Volkswagen camper van. Think about
what was the tagline for that car? Probably not. Things just work.
No. The tagline for that car was, "We'll catch on fire in the Macy's parking lot."
Why does it smell like burrito farts? That's the other tagline. We're not in the market for a new car yet, but here's our other ambition. In a couple of years, we might buy a house, and when we do, we'd like to get a fully electric car, probably the Nissan Leaf. But the thing that's stopping us right now is that you have to have a charging station, and they're like $1,000, and you have to have a garage to install it in, so it's tough at a rental.
Oh, certainly. That sounds like another beautiful goal for you, Steelman. I hope that you achieve it.
We might just buy it communally with our neighborhood. That's the plan, just to share it.
So, guys, I did recently also buy a car. It was from a small dealership where the people that worked at the dealership pretty much exclusively spoke Spanish. So my wife had to do most of the dealing in order to make it happen.
So you finally got a good deal?
Even with that, I don't know that we did. So now I'm driving I believe it's a 2006 Hyundai Accent. It's green apple. It's about the size of the desk I'm sitting at now. If you were going to look at it and think, like, who's driving this car, you'd think teenage girl or sad male nurse, and boom, I'm number two. I'm sad male nurse.
I think Hyundai's are really fine cars. The South Koreans know how to do it right.
Oh yeah, no, South and North Korea, they both can put together excellent cars.
So, Dave, do you think there was a reason why Ariane chose that car for you?
I don't know if she was hoping to emasculate me further by me driving that car, but it's worked. It's worked well.
She tells the salespeople in Spanish she needed to take the testosterone level down a bit at home, so she's like, we'll just get this car for Dave.
You're already a male nurse. Let's just confirm it that you're a male nurse by having you drive this car. We want everyone. I'm going to get a vanity plate as well. Yeah, MERS, I believe it'll say. MERS.
You know, Dave, I thought it would have been awesome if she had got you one of those, like, late 90s, early 2000 Volkswagen Bugs that have the big daisy hubcaps, you know? Have you ever remember seeing those?
Yes.
They made those in bright colors, too.
I remember I had a roommate once that he had one of those, and he got rid of it so he could drive then a Mini Cooper. So he went from the most girly car you could own to the most girly car you could possibly own. It's fantastic.
Sweet.
So what could you sum up from what are your pro tips?
Number one, don't let non-mechanical cosmetic details put you off a car. They usually help you get a better deal. It doesn't matter how it looks, it's how it runs.
Howard, what do you got? We need 3 points.
Right, 3 points. I would say number two is private sale every time. Stay away from the stealership, Jensen.
Nice.
You've been burned twice. If you do it again, shame on you, buddy.
Yep.
What you need to do, you need to come up to Vegas. You, me, and Jordan, we're going to meet in Vegas. You get dollars cash. We're going to get you a sweet car because we're going to put that on the roulette table, turn it into 20 grand. You're going to be set, man.
This sounds like
that's
a pro tip.
That's point number two.
You get two Spanish speakers and a lawyer on as your sidekicks. You'll be doing awesome in the car world.
Look, you come wearing a suit and trim up your beard a little bit. I'll come wearing a suit. I'll tell them I'm your bodyguard. Jordan is your legal representative. It'll be great, man.
Shark skin. Wear shark skin. That's what I vote for.
My third point was going to be get someone else to negotiate for you because you're probably incompetent. So that's my point.
Love it. Those are some great pro tips. I went to a thrift store and bought probably the greatest purchase I've made in years. It was not clothing, surprisingly. It was a board game made by the infamous board game company called Zabmondo! !
Whoa!
Yeah, they're good. They're good.
The game is called Would You Rather? And it's literally just hundreds of Would You Rather questions. And I could not believe my luck. I was so ecstatic about this. This confirmed. So I have a coworker who likes playing Would You Rather games. But for him, it's always, would you rather this good thing or this other good thing? And that's not the point of Would You Rather.
No, no.
For me, it's like, would you rather some terrible thing or some even more terrible thing?
Of course, yeah.
But I want to give you guys a couple of Would You Rather questions. This first one I think you'll both love. Would you rather have to walk on 5-foot stilts for the rest of your life? Or always have to ride a unicycle to get around?
Oh, easy. Unicycle, without a doubt. I already know how to ride one. Once you get good on those things, you can go upstairs, downstairs, in and out of restrooms. You could eat at the dinner table while you're riding it. I mean, it's no problem, man. Perfect.
I don't want to do either. We all have seen the unicycle guy riding around a college campus. There's always at least one unicycle guy.
There's one on our podcast right now.
But I got to go unicycle as well. It's the only way to go there.
Wow. You've gotten over this fear of being the shortest guy around, huh? You don't care about the stilts anymore.
No, I drive a 2006 Hyundai Accent. So I got to be comfortable with who I am.
Cool. All right, here's another one. Would you rather have a front tooth permanently chipped or have a noticeable scar on your cheek?
Scar, man.
Scar, no doubt.
Yeah, that one's not even a difficult choice.
Yeah, who's going to pick the chipped tooth? Scars are cool.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's because we've got nice teeth here. If we didn't have bad teeth.
Okay, here's another classic one from the pain, fear, discomfort category. Would you rather have hiccups 2 days a week or that burnt tongue feeling all of the time?
Whoa.
See, now we're getting into it. This is a real one.
Burnt tongue. And the reason is...
No!
Very important, man. I would rather look good on the outside and be just in pain on the inside.
Than have people think you're, like, permanently drunk 2 days a week.
You know, I mean, people think things about you if you've got hiccups. It's not good. I can't handle that.
I'm going with hiccups. Because what's more enjoyable than food? Yeah. And with that burnt tongue feeling, just anything, you're not going to enjoy the flavor, the taste of.
I have the burnt tongue feeling right now. It's awful. It's my most hated mouth feeling. And I have what's called, in Japan, they call it cat's tongue or cat's mouth. If the liquid is more than room temperature, it'll burn my mouth. And I'm like, oh, that's so hot. I can't handle warm drinks. And so I get that burnt tongue feeling really easily. And I hate it. It ruins my life. Here's a good one. Would you rather tell your boss he has a giant booger on his upper lip before a huge company meeting, or let him go in and hope he doesn't remember you had the opportunity to tell him? These are actually written. They're printed on cards. These are real questions.
I don't have a problem with either one of those, really. Maybe this is illuminating some social problems that I have, but I'll tell you got a booger on your lip, or I'll sit back and take great delight in you getting busted in front of a large group of people with a booger on your lip, which reminds me of that one time. Yeah, no, I would do the second, definitely. I mean, I would just pee my pants laughing so hard at someone doing a presentation with a booger on their lip.
I think it depends on the presentation we're about to go into. If it's just coworkers, everyone's going to have a good laugh. Great. If it's like a real professional presentation, I think I'd let them know. Okay, there's a booger.
Yeah, this is really revealing of the detail of the differences between Dave and Matt here. I appreciate the psychological insight. Okay, here's the last one. This one's my favorite.
I'll never tell, ever. Yeah.
Would you rather have your thumb and first finger glued together for life in the okay sign? Or be forced to say thank you before every sentence?
I want both, because I just think, you know, sometimes I'm not like the most agreeable person. Sometimes people look at me and think, man, that guy looks like a grumpy, arrogant jerk. But if I said thank you and had my fingers permanently in the okay shape, people would like just naturally find me more approachable and would like me more.
Yeah, it's true.
That could be good.
You'd be a real winner.
I just want the fingers. That's fine. Be the okay guy. Like, that guy's always okay. That guy's great. It's fantastic. Everyone around town would be like, the okay guy, he's here. Doing okay, guys.
Oh, man. I don't even know how you play this board game, but sometimes I'll just read these cards for hours at a time.
Isn't that an offensive gesture somewhere, isn't it? The okay sign?
You don't worry about that, though, Dave.
Okay.
It's when you start inserting things into the O that it becomes offensive.
Why would that be offensive?
I don't know. Depends on your facial gesture at the time, I suppose. Well, okay. So that brings us to the end of Would You Rather. Thanks so much for participating. We've got two more segments before we close out this episode. The first is our music segment, Unchained Melodies. And we have a theme today that will bring tears to your eyes. It's unrequited love. As you can imagine, this is probably half of all songs recorded have been recorded by men about heartbreak. So we had a huge, huge library to choose from, and we have some real winners. Howard, you want to start us off with your first pick for Unrequited Love?
First pick was Sylvia's Mother by the band Dr. Hook from the 1970s. a sad but beautiful song. I've spent many hours just trying to relate to every... I feel like I can relate to everyone in the story. I can relate to Sylvia. I can relate to her mother. I can relate to the person singing the song. It really pulls my heart.
Sylvia's mother says Sylvia's busy, too busy to come to the phone. Sylvia's mother says Sylvia's trying to start a new life of her own. Sylvia's mother says Sylvia's happy, so why don't you leave her alone? And the operator says 40 cents more for the next 3 minutes, please. Mrs. Avery, I just gotta talk to her. I'll only keep her a while. Please, Mrs. Avery, I just wanna tell her goodbye.
And Howard, years ago, we were having a conversation about Dr. Hook, as we often did, and I remember telling you that they may have better songs, but this is their highest artistic achievement that they've ever had, is this song.
And I agree with you, David. It is, yeah, it's a shame, too, that for 40 cents, he's going to have to hang up the phone. I mean, it's a beautiful song, man.
He's in a hard way. He's in a hard way.
I just think it's remarkable that that same artist contain such multitudes that he could record a song like that and You Make My Pants Want to Get Up and Dance. That man could do it all.
And Baby Makes Her Blue Jeans Talk. That's a great one.
That could also be about unrequited love. Yeah.
It really could. All right, Dave, what do you got for us?
It's a cover by Van Morrison. It's about love and when there's heartbreak and when things are just not working out for you. It's called Ain't Nothing You Can Do. And I remember I was talking to a friend of mine one time. He was telling me about he'd just had his heart broken. I told him, just listen to this song, because there ain't nothing you can do.
When you got a headache, it ain't part of Sue's afraid. Go right by this sleep, and you'll feel all right again. When you got a backache, a little rubber seal through. When you got a heartache, ain't nothing you can do. Man, ain't nothing you can do. Ain't nothing you can do. When you got a heartache, ain't nothing you can do. A man can't break a stone. Tries another lick. Ice man can't break his eyes, so he buys another pick. And electric lights go out, a candlelight will see you through. When you got a heartache, ain't nothing you can do.
Were either of you guys familiar with that song?
Yeah, I love Van Morrison. I've listened to probably everything he's ever recorded.
And I think it's really cathartic to listen to that song. I think it actually helps when you have a heartache, because there ain't nothing you can do. Van Morrison knows. He's telling you. There's nothing you can do, man.
That's a great one. Thanks, Dave. All right, here's my choice for my first song. There's something I love about Biz Markie. He's probably the hip-hop artist who, like, wears his heart on his sleeve the most. Like, he's the guy that I could imagine, even though he's a talented rapper, just totally striking out with women all the time everywhere, and then being honest about it in a song. Like admitting his love failings. Because there's so much posturing and boasting about dominating women and how you're a great lover and all the women want to be with you. But with Biz Markie, it's just the opposite. And this is his classic, Just a Friend.
Have you ever met a girl that you tried to date, but a year to make love, she wanted you to wait? Let me tell you a story of my situation. I was talking to this girl from the U.S. nation. The way that I met her was on tour at a concert. She had long hair and a short miniskirt. I just got on stage dripping, pouring with sweat. I was walking through the crowd, and guess who I met? I whispered in her ear, come to the picture booth so I can ask you some questions and see if you're 100 proof. I asked her her name, she said blah, blah, blah. She had 9-10 pants and a very big bra. I took a couple of flicks and she was enthused. I said, how do you like the show? She said I was very amused. I started throwing bass, she started throwing back mid-range. But when I sprung the question, she acted kind of strange. Then when I asked, do you have a man? She tried to pretend. She said, no, I don't. I only have a friend. Come on, I'm not even going for it. It's what I'm going to say.
You got what I need. But you say he just a friend. And you say he just a friend. Oh, baby, you got what I need. But you say he just a friend. But you say he just a friend. Oh, baby, you got what I need. But you say he just a friend. But you say he just a friend.
Oh, man. The song doesn't end well.
Yeah, it's a love tragedy.
Tragedy. Nah. Howard, yeah, I think of you. You're the one that introduced me to that beautiful song.
Really?
And you know, yeah, you know how I appreciate a man that can't really sing.
Dave once told me that many of the stories I have that he likes the most start out with this sentence. I was on a bus in Mexico when... I was woken up to the sound of this song. It's Por Unas Monedas by Pepe Aguilar. And it was one of those, if you've ever been woken up by music that you're not sure if you're in dreaming or if you're in heaven. And the words to this song, which I'll give you guys a rough translation because I know you'll need it, but it says something to the point of finish this story, point directly at my heart and fire point blank. I swear you do me a favor. After wow. You, there's nothing new. Everything I had, I give it to you. Wanting with your love to touch the heavens, instead, all I earned was hell. The song's beautiful.
Acaba de una vez con esta historia. Apúntame directo al corazón. Dispara fríamente a quemarropa. Te juro que me haces un favor. Después de ti no existe nada nuevo. Si todo cuanto tuve te lo di, queriendo con tu amor tocar el cielo. Resulta que el infierno me gané, y solo porque tú me cambiaste por unas monedas. Solo porque tú no supiste soportar mi pobreza, y solo porque tú te vendiste por unas monedas, y solo porque tú no supiste soportar mi pobreza.
That guy's like a Mexican Andrea Bocelli.
He is the typical macho Mexican man that just breaks down and cries over every love relationship he's ever had.
There's a sadness there that touched my heart. It touched me so much that it made me change my next selection. I want Phil Collins, Against All Odds. It just seems to go hand in hand with what Howard just picked, and it's beautiful.
How can I just let you walk away? Just let you leave. Love.
That's real emotion. That's real heartbreak. I listened to this radio story once about so-called torch songs. This woman had her heart broken, and she wanted to write a torch song as good as Phil Collins. And he actually came on the radio and talked with her about it, and he was super cool. He talked about the real emotion that went into writing this song. It was from real Phil Collins heartbreak. And after that, I love Phil Collins.
That's awesome. So I was going to play another torch song, which was Harry Nilsson's Without You. But everybody knows that song, and Mariah Carey kind of ruined it. So instead, I'm going to play a song that it turns the tables a little bit. There's some hope. Even if you've been spurned by a lover, you can still come back and do something with yourself. And this is a hit from Motown called Do You Love Me by The Contours.
You broke my heart 'cause I couldn't dance. You didn't even want me around. And now I'm back to let you know I can really shake them down.
That's the opening song on a little dance mix that we play for Cedar like every day. And so I hear that song all the time. I just love it.
I love how that song really hits on the importance of being able to dance. I think a lot of these guys would have grasped onto that concept. They wouldn't have had to write so many unrequited love songs.
Yeah, that's really a pro tip right there, that song.
Because that's
learn
really...
how to dance and then let everyone know.
Because we all know that was Phil Collins' main problem. He couldn't dance well.
Yeah. I can't dance. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's it. Man, what a great Unchained Melodies. We got to end this episode here, and we're going to end it, as always, with some book wisdom. And Matt, I think you have the book wisdom this week. What do you got for us?
I do. I have a book titled A Million Miles in a Thousand Years by Donald Miller. I'll give you a little backstory before I read this. He writes memoir, and he wrote a memoir that took off, became a bestseller, called Blue Like Jazz. About 3 or 4 years after it was written, some movie producers approached him and wanted to turn it into a movie. And he said, great. And they sat down to write the movie, the screenplay. And he ended up having to change a lot of the things out of the book. And they told him the reason they had to change him is because his story as it was, wasn't interesting enough to make a movie. His life was kind of boring. And as you can imagine, that was kind of gave him pause to think, you know, what'd been going on with his life, why it was so boring. So he went about studying the concept of story, what it means to make a good story, and ended up writing a book about that. I'll read you the intro and then a chapter out of it. But it starts like this. It says, if you watched a movie about a guy who wanted a Volvo and worked for years to get it, you wouldn't cry at the end when he drove off the lot testing the windshield wipers. You wouldn't tell your friends you saw a beautiful movie or go home and put on a record to think about the story you'd seen. The truth
except
is you wouldn't remember that movie a week later, except you'd feel robbed and want your money back. Nobody cries at the end of a movie about a guy who wants to own a Volvo. But we spend years actually living those stories and expect our lives to be meaningful. The truth is, if what we choose to do with our lives won't make a meaningful story, it won't make a meaningful life.
Wow.
Then he goes on and talks about this kayaking trip that he did. He says it's like this. He says, when you live a story, the first part happens fast. You throw yourself into the narrative and you're finally out in the water. The shore is pushing off behind you and the trees are getting smaller. The distant shore doesn't seem so far. You can feel the resolution coming, the feeling of getting out of your boat and walking to the distant beach. You think the thing is going to happen fast. You think you'll paddle for a bit and arrive on the other side by lunch. But the truth is, it isn't going to be over soon. What you get from a story is always less than you thought it would be, and the work is harder than you imagined. The point of a story is never about the ending, remember? It's about your character getting molded into the hard work of the middle. At some point, the shore behind you stops getting smaller, and you paddle and wonder why the same strokes that used to move you now only rock the boat. You got the wife, but you don't know if you like her anymore, and you've only been married 5 years. You want to wake up and walk in the living room in your underwear and watch football and let your daughters play with the dog because the far shore doesn't get closer no matter how hard you paddle. The shore you left is just as distant, and there's no going back. There's only the decision to paddle in place or to stop, slide out of the hatch, and sink into the sea. Maybe there's another story at the bottom of the sea. Maybe you don't have to be in the story anymore. I think this is when most people give up on their stories. They come out of college wanting to change the world, wanting to get married, wanting to have kids, and change the way people buy office supplies. But they get into the middle and discover it was harder than they thought. They can't see the distant shore anymore, and they wonder if their paddling is moving them forward. None of the trees behind them are getting smaller, and none of the trees ahead are getting bigger. They take it out on their spouses, and they go looking for an easier story.
Boom.
Boom.
I think I would like to see that Volvo movie. Depending on how it was done, it could be good.
Dave, I'm pretty sure I saw it. It was a great documentary. I'd love to tell you about it in the next episode.
Yeah, we could spend an hour talking about it.
But it's a little ironic because this guy, he wrote this book, and then in the process of writing this book ended up becoming so in love with the principles of story that he started a marketing firm about stories, and now he makes commercials for cars.
Nice.
7 years later, you know, the ironic twists. But I gave this book to my little brother, who's more literary minded. This is kind of a bestseller, and he said it reads like a podcast. And I don't know if I only made it to 60 pages because I couldn't handle the self-deprecating pandering to the masses, which is why I loved it personally.
Sweet. I want to have your brother on the show. He sounds like my kind of guy.
You know, I was thinking the same thing, man. You'd love it. We were on our family vacation last week, and he read me some of his poetry, and I was fast asleep within 2 minutes.
Nice. That's a sign it's probably good, huh? Oh, Matt, it's been great having you on. I'm sorry we waited this long, and I'm glad you didn't make fun of us mercilessly through the whole thing.
Hey, you're welcome. There's always next time.
Okay.
Thanks, Matt. Well, yeah, let's talk again.
That'd be great, Dave.
Well, we're best friends, Howard, so we're going to talk again. Don't worry.
Off the chain. It's off the chain.
Did I tell you about my brother-in-law?
You told me about your one brother-in-law that has like a really nice house but lives in the garage.
Yeah, it's the same guy. So right now he has some land and he's building one of those 400-foot square houses that's portable.
Where I come from, we call that a trailer. Tiny house that's portable. The tiny house park.
That's way nicer than trailer park, Howard.
Yeah, because this is it's not tenable. Not a long-term solution.
No one ever thinks that a trailer is a long-term solution, Howard, but then it just becomes one.